Thank you for tuning in to this episode of PageCast, presented by Jonathan Paul Publishers. Today's episode features Rhodes and His Banker by Richard Stein. Rhodes and His Banker is an account of the remarkable friendship between a larger-than-life historical figure and a modest, unassuming banker, both of whom were personally involved in all the major political and financial developments in Southern Africa during the closing decades of the 19th century. Intertwining dual narratives of Cecil John Rhodes as an entrepreneur with the Standard Bank under Sir Lewis Mitchell tiptoeing in his wake to become the biggest bank in Africa, Stein recounts how colonialism and capitalism took root in South Africa and what was then known as Rhodesia. In this episode, Richard engages in a lovely conversation with strategist, media specialist, and writer David Gorin. Enjoy.
Hello, everybody. I'm Dave Gorin. I'm interviewing the author Richard Stein, who has written his latest book called Rhodes and His Banker, Empire, Wealth, and the Coming of Union. Richard, how are you?
I'm well, thank you, David.
Richard, this is, if I'm correct, your sixth book about sort of late 19th century, early 20th century South African history, predominantly on sort of, shall we call them, giant influential characters.
Well, yes, but I look at angles that other people haven't written about. I mean, Milner was a big giant influential character, but nobody in no South African had written an account of his life. So, and no South African had written an account of Smuts and Churchill's life or relationship. So I do look for sort of different angles, but the connection is certainly I've gone for the major players towards the end of the 19th century and the early 20th century. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. The obvious question would be, Rhodes is very much a bête noir at the moment, isn't he? He has been for a while.
Indeed. He is.
Yeah. And in fact, there's a bit of an elephant in the room because I have to ask you whether you pondered doing him seriously. And if so, what reservations did you perhaps have in your own mind? And then with consciousness of that you feel you may have overcome in the book.
Well, look, I started this book has three components. The one is the Standard Bank and its growth and its development in South Africa of the 19th century. The second, and this is really what the book is about, is its third general manager, Lewis Mitchell, who took the bank from being quite substantial into being the bank of South Africa by the end of the century, by the time of the Boer War. But Rhodes, being the most prominent businessman of that time, is obviously the major figure in the book. But this is not a biography of Rhodes. This is the story of Lewis Mitchell and his opinion of Rhodes through his own eyes rather than mine. Although, I mean, he was an acolyte of, became a disciple of Rhodes, if you like. I have in many places indicated where I think the truth was rather different. But I had to, it was fascinating researching Rhodes because, yes, he is unpopular these days, but there's almost a caricature of Rhodes which has developed. And in all my histories, I just try to explain what people, why they did what they did. And in Rhodes' case, there was much that he did was good, but there was an awful lot that he did that wasn't. And I just try to take both sides in the book, explain both sides in the book, even though I'm not an admirer of Rhodes, but I admire some of the things he did.
I think that sums up a lot of people's feelings as well, and my own too, Richard. I mean, on that note, I came across just purely by chance, sort of halfway through reading your book. there's a quote from the American poet and civil rights advocate Maya Angelou. "I have great respect for the past. If you don't know where you've come from, you don't know where you're going. And then she sort of repeats it again. I have great respect for the past, but I'm a person of the moment. I'm here and I do my best to be completely centered at the place I'm at and then go forward to the next. So to me, that sort of encapsulates, I think, part of the problem with, if we can call it a problem, with general lack of acknowledgement about Rhodes's colossal contribution, if we like to, to the formation of our country, if you agree what I mean, Richard.
I couldn't agree more. Very much underrated and really unknown about today, as far as I can see.
Yeah. And yet, okay, so let's just pause on that thought, because I agree with you that your book takes a very balanced approach to him. But let's just pause and let's go back to do you pronounce it Michel? I thought it was Lewis Mitchell, but I realized that the T is missing. So yes, it must be Michel. Is that right?
I pronounce it Michel, and we've always in the bank have spoken to Michel. He actually pronounced it Michel, I gather, the other day, when I came across somebody who knew one of his sons. So but I'm calling him Michel because I always have.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I found it quite interesting the way you contrasted Rhodes with, as you say, his acolyte, and Michel very much was an acolyte of his. He was a huge supporter, not only in terms of the financing and the capital provision for Rhodes's expanding empire, but also just his beliefs.
Started off in conflict, as you know.
That's true.
At odds, and then became friends. Yeah.
And it was quite extraordinary, I think, that, you know, what comes through quite strongly for me, Richard, is they were deep friends, and ultimately on the same, if we can call it, colonial or imperialist page. But their moral makeup was completely the opposite. You know, Rhodes, there's a section in your book where you convey that Rhodes actually asked Michel for a loan, £10,000, to arrange a murder. And he was quite open. He told Michel that he was arranging a murder. And then sort of a few, you know, 50 or so pages later, when Rhodes asks Michel to become a trustee of his and offers to pay him, Michel outright refuses. He doesn't want any payment at all. So I thought that was quite interesting, you know, the way you contrast the moral fabric of the two men.
Yes, their codes were different, indeed.
Yes. And yet, coming back to Rhodes, I was struck towards the end of the book how, you know, when he died, he received accolades from all over the subcontinent, including quite extraordinarily the Ndebele leaders and warriors whom he'd literally crushed as part of forming Rhodesia, as it was known then.
Yeah. Well, those are the days of big men and kings, and, you know, you fought wars, and if you won, you became, you know, the hero and the paramount chief of the tribe or whatever you became. But yes, they sort of forgave him. They said this was seemed to be all fair and love and war, and Gurla's son named some of his kids after Rhodes. So very odd.
And Richard, I mean, I don't know if you agree with me on this, but I to be honest, I did find parts of the book quite tricky to understand, not having been in merchant banking or really knowing all that much about financing. And you're a banker, aren't you? That was your career.
No, I'm not. Oh. I'm not a banker. I worked in the bank for a while in the communications department, but I'm not a banker.
Right. Okay. Yeah, there were a few sections where I really had to sort of read carefully to understand what Rhodes was doing with his mergers and acquisitions, for example, of when he formed De Beers.
Look, it's a very complex story. I try to make it as simple as possible, and obviously haven't succeeded entirely. But this is a difficult book to write because I was addressing sort of several different audiences, and I agree with you. The banking, I had to do the banking bit. Because it's interesting in itself, but the details of it were sometimes difficult to explain.
No, fair enough. I mean, it's not as though they take up too much of a reader's time. It's just that sometimes, as I say, for example, with the when he was consolidating and buying up all the smaller diamond mining operations in Kimberley. You know, and then he, all Rhodes's sort of maneuvers to form De Beers, and then, just quite
that was very complex. There are all sorts of different companies, French involved. I know that. And, I, as I say, I tried to sort of simplify it to its essentials, but, it wasn't easy to explain.
Right. Yeah. No, fair enough. Yeah. And then this is something quite unusual, perhaps, Richard, a strange comment, but I was also struck by how South Africa really was, you know, not too much more than 130, 150 years ago, a complete backwater.
Absolutely.
You know, before the discovery of mines, we were literally, as you point out in the book, early chapters, we were a wool economy, and that was it.
Wool and ostrich feathers and a bit of fruit.
Yes.
Yeah.
Quite incredible how diamonds in particular initially, and then gold, of course, 20 or so years later, just catalyzed an entire nation.
Yeah, indeed.
And as you, I think, bringing in the banking angle, because, of course, capital is critical to gigantic mining operations, isn't it?
And, of course, Rhodes was able to call on Beit, who was really the financial genius behind a lot of his transactions. And then Beit introduced him to Lord Rothschild in England, who also helped at critical moments. So he had all the connections, but the financiers were absolutely key to the whole story.
Yeah, yeah. And speaking of that, you know, Michelle's side of the book, the rise, shall we say, or the formation of Standard Bank in South Africa, and then the gigantic and important company that it became in our history, and still today, of course. I mean, I find it really interesting how, you know, but both men actually, Rhodes and Michelle, they had to travel the world so much. Well, I say the world, but mainly, of course, between London and South Africa. But again, I guess this goes to my earlier question about, you know, communications in those days. You know, so Rhodes would travel, you know, from Cape Town by steamship to London. And then there was a section in your book where he flits across to Europe and he meets, I think, Kaiser Wilhelm. And then
he does.
And then he goes across to Cairo to start exploring the idea of a telegraph system between Cape Town and Cairo. And then back to Italy or back to France? I forget where. And then.
Yes. They traveled amazingly. Yeah.
Yeah, Michel too. He also does a huge amount of traveling, doesn't he?
He goes back regularly, goes home, and he does. And even while the war was on, the First World War was on, he was doing it.
Extraordinary also the way they traveled inside the country by literally oxcart.
Absolutely. And then across roads that either weren't there or were in pretty appalling condition. But you had to do it. They had time, obviously, which one doesn't have these days, and everything moved at a very much slower pace.
Yeah, yeah, really incredible. Richard, let's come back to Rhodes for a second. I found it quite interesting that, you know, he's this. I think I didn't know that his name or his nickname was the Colossus.
Well, not always with affection, I must add, by his critics as well, but he behind his back,
And I also didn't know that he actually was, well, first of all, as you mentioned, he was an acquaintance of Lord Rothschild, and also that he had regular meetings with Queen Victoria. That was quite eye-opening to me.
Quite irregular. I think there were two where she asked him to either dinner or lunch and asked him. I think there may have been another one as well. But so in that sense, they were regular, but not sort of every time he went to England, he didn't call on the Queen. But he got lots of – but he did dine with her twice, which was more than many people did.
Well, yeah. And then there was a lovely phrase. I'm just picking out a few little things that stood out for me. His words, unctuous rectitude. I can't remember.
Yes.
Maybe you can recall. What was he referring to when he used that phrase, Richard?
Well, he was talking about his critics of his exploits in Rhodesia, and he said they were all, you know, they deplored what he, you know, the war mongering that he'd done in Rhodesia and the loss of life and so on, and he. And Rhodes felt that he was had to do that in the interests of the British Empire, but the critics, his critics in the on the liberal benches in Parliament, were very, very critical of what he'd done, and that he talked about their unctuous rectitude, because, you know, colonial wars all over the place, and but he was being singled out for criticism, and he used that, and he liked that phrase. He repeated it quite often. Michelle told him not to use it, but he didn't take any notice.
Right. Was that, would that have been before the Jameson raid, or I can't remember the timeline there?
Let me think. No, it was after the Jameson raid. It was after the Jameson raid. Okay. And it was, I tell you when it was, actually, it was around the time of the parliamentary select committee hearing in England. And he was, when the report came out, he was roundly, they laid the blame for the raid on Rhodes, which he always expected. And Michelle said to him, you know, they were all going to go for you. And he said, yes, I know, but, you know, it's their unctuous rectitude that gets on my nerves. That's what the context of it was.
Right. Yeah. And speaking of the Jameson raid, I often thought it should be called the Rhodes raid. You know, he was the architect, wasn't he, in the plotter?
Absolutely. Yeah, he was. So Jameson, of course, jumped the gun very foolishly, yes. But Rhodes was the architect. They planned this for quite a while.
Yeah. And of course, for listeners who may not be, you know, all that familiar with it, I mean, essentially, the Jameson raid was the catalyst for the Second Anglo-Boer War, wasn't it?
Well, it certainly led to it. It confirmed Kruger's suspicion that that the British were after him, they were after his country. It didn't lead directly to the Anglo-Boer War. It was certainly a major contributor in the sense of making the Boers absolutely, Kruger particularly, absolutely resolute in not coming to any sort of agreement with Milner in Bloemfontein when they met. Because the Afrikaners, the Cape, many Afrikaners didn't want the war, but Kruger didn't want it either. But he realized that he had to fight it because the Brits were not going to leave him alone. And I think he was right in that respect.
I was actually, speaking of Kruger, I mean, there are a lot of, shall we call them secondary or peripheral characters that you weave into the story. Yeah. And of course, rightfully so. I mean, there was a lot of complex history unraveling in all four parts of Southern Africa, five if you include then called. Zambezia? Is that correct, Richard?
Zambezia was early. Yes, it was.
Yes, yeah. So, I was struck by, you know, how, you know, for example, Kruger. He was incredibly, I think he got on well with Michelle, didn't he? Partly because, of course, Standard. He needed Standard as a bank of essentially a de facto central bank in Transvaal Republic.
He had a national bank up his sleeve. He wanted what is effectively a state bank, but that's what he wanted. Yes, he respected, I mean, he needed the bank. You know, a lot of the Boer generals banked with the bank. Kruger gave money to the bank before he went to, on deposit, before he went to see Milner. There were banking, you know, there weren't a lot of banks around. The Standard Bank was the leading bank, and I think they treated the bank with respect, and the bank treated them with great respect as well.
Yeah, in that respect, what also came through quite strongly for me was how Michel, he acted, we deported or comported himself very much like an archetypal banker, wasn't he? Like, he didn't want
to take
sides.
But the extraordinary thing was, what I find extraordinary today is that there seemed to be an acceptance that he could he could help Rhodes. I mean, he was known as Rhodes's advisor by that time. That didn't seem to be a conflict of interest. Although he was scrupulous in not taking any money from Rhodes, he was known to be on the side of Rhodes. And but Kruger and the Boers simply said, oh, well, these are all imperialists. I suppose we've jolly well got to put up with it. So, but it was odd that he was, you know, not many bankers would have got as close to the Prime Minister of the Cape as Michel did.
Yeah, well, and for that matter of the President of the Transvaal Republic, Kruger.
Yeah. Yeah, they were never close, but they were respectful of each other.
Yes, yeah, yeah. And, I mean, okay, so let's just come back to Rhodes a little bit, Richard. So, I mean, I'm quite conscious as well that despite our discussion, despite your book, that, you know, there will and will continue to be sort of, yeah, scornful and yeah, dismayed attitude to him in the country. So I guess my broader question is, how do you think your book might contribute to sort of some more balanced evaluation of Rhodes and his legacy?
Look, I try to point out, I think it will help to explain the complexity of Rhodes. You know, Robert Rotberg, the American Rhodes scholar, who happened to be a friend of mine, much older, but he spent 18 years researching Rhodes. He spent 6 years writing the book. He's written The Founder. I don't know if you've read it. It's a massive book, and it's a very good book on Rhodes. And his conclusion was that Rhodes cannot be encompassed or revealed in one direction. He achieved what he did because of his energy, and his vision was so much greater than any of the contemporaries at the time. That is really what I try to illustrate. You know, both the good he did, and the bad he did. I think fundamentally, the problem with Rhodes is that he. The most striking thing about him was he was this visionary imperialist there was a striking contrast between the nobility of his ends and the often ruthlessly cynical means he used to pursue those ends. A biographer noted that the gulf between his ideals and some of his practices was so great. And they were all the more remarkable because of his immense ability. So really what I'm saying, I want people to read the book to say, well, hell, this is one extraordinary character, not a very nice man, but you can't simply, as the present inclination is to do, to say, was he good, was he bad, and not go into the detail. If you go into the detail, you realize this was an unusual character who thought he was doing well in a lot of cases, but when push came to shove, was pretty ruthless in getting his own way. And that is the image I have of Rhodes. You know, you can't sort of tick all boxes and say, well, okay, on balance, he was a good guy because, or he was a bad guy because. It's like most great people. Movers and shakers in history, there's a good side and a bad side, and that's really what I've tried in most of my books to indicate. That history is complex.
Yes, yeah, indeed. Yeah, I've just actually earmarked this. I think it's from Rotberg, the biographer that you mentioned. I think you mentioned a quote here: as the diamond magnate, he demonstrated time and again when pushed to make a choice, he would set aside his moral scruples and overrun anyone black or white who stood in his way.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think in fact you use that quote in reference to the Glenn Gray Act.
The Glenn Gray Act. Yeah, but you see there again, I mean, some people have gone so far as to say the Glenn Gray Act essentially formed the first African township, if you like. The case, yes. Broader than township, and some scholars have said, oh, well, this is where, and Rhodes introduced a sort of past system, their means of control, and his critics said, you know, this was the beginning of apartheid in South Africa. Well, it's actually it wasn't. Liberal critics, on the other hand, criticized, were happy with the legislation, Merriman and others, because the first time it actually gave Africans tenure on land in their own area. They limited access and all the rest of it, but there was good and bad in that Green-Grey legislation. But that was, some of those measures were taken up into other legislation by other municipalities, and eventually, I suppose you could argue that the actual apartheid system was based on that, as kind of on confining Africans to their tribal areas, locations, and municipalities, and so on. But that's a bit of a stretch. And remember that, you know, Rhodes was no different from most politicians in trying to do something about the black-white issue, yes. And which looked very different 100 years ago from what it does now.
Yes, of course, yeah. In fact, that's another sort of interesting thread that comes through in your book, how, you know, all these movers and shakers, you know, from the gigantic, colossal people like Milner, like Rhodes, of course, himself, and even Joseph Chamberlain, the colonial secretary at the time, all the way through to even Michel on a more sort of, you know, shall we say, a more gentle moral foundation, they all saw South Africa's racial issue as a Dutch or a Boer versus an English or English-speaking issue, didn't they? That black people in South Africa were almost, or Southern Africa were almost, irrelevant to them.
Yeah. Yes. In that sense, at that point, it was they were very much concerned about English-Dutch relationships rather than black-white relationships. That is true, but you know that was 100 years ago, and things things were very different then. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'd like to touch briefly, Richard, on sort of something that comes up towards the end of the book, the National Convention, essentially to, I think it was 1908, 1909.
Yeah,
led to essentially, you know, a year or so later the Act of Union. I was quite amazed, actually, at the role that Michel played. He was consulted quite widely, and I think he participated in the convention, didn't he?
Well, he didn't have a vote. He was nominated by that stage. Rhodesia had nominated him, one of their three non-voting delegates at the convention. But interesting enough, I suspect because of his financial expertise, they couldn't have had many. There were politicians there, and a lot of them didn't have anywhere near Michel's experience in financing, banking. And I think that's where they called him in. And they called him in on the drafting. They had a small group. I think it was Smuts, Puerta, Merriman, and somebody else who drafted the responsible for drafting the draft constitution, and they called Michel, among others, in to help advise on certain aspects of it. But so that was an interesting thing. But you know, the what I haven't told you, and you haven't asked me about, David, was that when I first thought of trying to write something about Michel and Rhodes a long time ago, when I did the I was asked to update the 150th history of the Standard Bank in time for its anniversary, and I learned then that Michel was, and obviously heard of Rhodes, and the fact that they had come across each other and had moved from acrimony to harmony and then in the long run. But this book is based so much on Michel's autobiography, unpublished autobiography. And when I started the book, I thought that in fact it would the end of the book would come when Rhodes died and Michel moved on, because that's all they, because if you look at any reference to Michel in South African history books, they all refer to chapters 4 to 10 of his unpublished autobiography, which is in the Standard Bank archives, and the original of which is in the Cape archives. Well, when the first thing I did, I only knew when I set out to write the book that this would, I only got the seven chapters which dealt with his time at Standard Bank, which Standard Bank had printed and kept in its archives, and the rest it had handed over to the Cape archives. Well, the first thing I went to do a couple of years ago, asked my brother to do, was to go to the Cape archives and find the full autobiography. And we couldn't find it. They didn't know where it was. The place was in usual sort of in disarray. It was COVID, and you know what things were like in those days. But we heard that there was a, somebody said, you may find it, it's at Yale. Well, lo and behold, it was at Yale. And thanks to Charles and Onsen and a couple of people with Yale connections, I managed to get a copy sent on a disc of the whole unpublished autobiography. And it was only then that I realized that Michelle had a life after banking that was actually quite fascinating, because he wrote a biography of Rhodes. He went into politics. He helped get the Rhodes scholarships off the ground. He went to the National Convention. He was a big cheese in the British South Africa Company, which was really ran Rhodesia. So he did an awful lot after that, after Rhodes' death. And the thing is, I don't think that anybody else has actually read that. So I'm hoping that this might open a new avenue for historians now who've got the whole, I've given the transcript to the Standard Bank archives, and I hope that this might sort of open up another window on Rhodes, even if it was posthumous, that wasn't available earlier. So that's why I hope that people will find this book interesting, because I don't think anybody else has really been able to read this unpublished autobiography, which is very difficult to read, I may add, in parts because it's so faded. But there it is.
Yeah. No, absolutely, Richard. I think you accomplished that very well, if I may say, because, you know, like, for example, I mean, Standard Bank, well, they're a gigantic South African brand, aren't they? But we just sort of, we see them in our sort of urban landscape, and I guess the rural landscape too, in many rural towns in South Africa. And we don't really think of their history as a company. You know, who formed it? How did it grow to become such a gigantic company in the country? As you successfully do in the book, what role did they play in building the country to what it is today, for good and for bad? You know? So I do think you accomplished that well. But the reason I was in particular asking about the National Convention is because, again, one doesn't realize all the smaller role players at that critical juncture in our history. You know, it's like Michelle, and in fact, correct me if I'm wrong, I think he was actually knighted as well for something he did just before the convention. Is that correct, Richard?
That's correct. He was actually on the military affairs board. There was a board set up to adjudicate on Boer prisoners. Role in the Anglo-Boer War in the Cape. It was set up, and Michelle was most amused because he was knighted for that by Chamberlain, when he'd really for simply being chairman of the board and not doing it over a couple of years, and not really for what the contribution he'd made to British South Africa relations over many, many years. But that's when he was knighted. It was, I think it was in about 1905. It was after the Boer War. Yes, it had nothing to do with his banking expertise at all. It was just that he was, as I say, was head of the military board in the Cape.
Now, it's very interesting sort of little anecdotes and snippets. And of course, I think what you also bring quite clearly into the book is, he had a beautiful sort of style of writing himself, didn't he? I mean,
Yes, he wrote well. He's a clever man. Unusually for a banker, a diarist, kept notes, wrote his thoughts down. As I suppose when people had more time in those days, and I suppose, you know, he used his time well. It's a comprehensive 600, nearly 700 pages of typescript now. And there's a lot in that, a lot in the book.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. Well, Richard, I have, I think, just one sort of can zoom out, one sort of last question for you. So you've written 6 books now, and do you have any idea who your 7th one might focus upon?
I thought you might ask me that. I'm not going to make myself a hostage to fortune. I've got an idea. I have probably one more book in me, but I don't know. I'll see how it develops. I'm not getting any younger, and I've done half a dozen. I might do a 7th, but I'm certainly not going to tell you what it's about, because everybody's going to ask me, how's your book on Joseph going? And I simply don't want to answer those sort of questions.
Fair enough, yeah. I did ask it with my tongue in my cheek. No, but Richard, honestly, I think I've read 4 of your 6 now, and I do have one that I'm going to dig out of my bookshelf and actually read. So I'm going to get to the 5th one shortly. I do think you've got a skill in being able to sort of bring complex issues to a relatively simple sort of narrative that is easy to read, you know, and hence to grow people's understanding of South African history. And I think it's a shame that, and it's not unique to South Africa, as you know, but people all around the world are so poor at understanding anything about where we've come from, you know, to draw back to the quote from Maya Angelou.
Yeah, well, if, you know, I can do a bit of that. It's really written for my children's generation. And just to say that we've got a fascinating history. And, you know, don't let it just run into the sand. Winners, as I say always, you know, winners rewrite history. But we've got an import. We punched well above our weight 100 years ago and changed the course of the British Empire. And that's the period that interests me. And so that's what I've sort of spent my last few years doing, writing about.
No, congratulations, Richard. As I say, I've really enjoyed reading most of your books. And yeah, thanks for the chat, Richard. I've appreciate your time. And yeah, fascinating to talk to you again. Just to repeat, it's Rhodes and His Banker, Empire, Wealth, and the Coming of the Union by Richard Stain. Thanks, Richard. All the best, eh?
All the best. Thanks, David.
Thanks for listening to this episode of PageCast. We love hearing from you. So if you'd like to get in touch, please contact us at pagecastpodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, keep reading and listening.